Dear, I thought I'd drop a line. The weather's cool, the folks are fine.
This is Western Kentucky University Libraries Podcast. This channel is about the WKU Libraries Kentucky Life program offered free to WKU and Bowling Green communities at Barnes & Noble Booksellers. The episode you are listening to features Nancy Baird, Kentucky History Specialist for University Libraries. She presented Western Kentucky University the First 100 Years, 1906 to 2006, on April the 6th. Baird, Carol Crow Carrico, Distinguished University Professor of History, and Sue Lynn Stone McDaniel, University Archivist, are co-authors of this beautiful illustrated history book. Introducing Nancy is Dr. Brian Kutz, Head of Department of Library Public Services of WKU Libraries. Since the lecture is recorded in real time, we are sorry for the background noise.
My name is Brian Kutz, and as Head of the Department of Library Public Services, with my colleague Peggy Wright, I coordinate the series Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by Trace Diecast. Our speaker tonight, active professionally, and always in demand as a public speaker. She was the Librarian of the Year at WKU in 1992 and won a University Public Service Award that same year. Her distinguished research career was profiled in the fall issue of the Western Scholar in 2001. It's fitting on the occasion of the University Centennial to welcome Nancy Baird, one of the authors of the new Centennial History of the University.
Thank you. Several years ago, two of my colleagues, Carol Crow Carrico and Sue Lynn McDaniel, and I began preparing an illustrated history as our contribution to the university's 100th birthday. Our goal was to produce something that would be both informative and attractive. We combed the university archives, and from its more than 12,000 photographs, we selected about 350 that we believed were the most interesting and that told the history of Western. 10 years earlier, Professor Lowell Harrison had published a fine scholarly history of the university. Certainly, we did not wish to redo Dr. Harrison's work, nor could we have done so had we tried. And so we wrote, cut, rewrote, eliminated. We burned lots of midnight oil, but we're pleased with the results. Not all departments, alas, or all events are acknowledged. Nor does the history include all students and everyone's favorite faculty member. The fruits of our labor have been published and are ready for sale. When you see it, we hope that you will agree that our work is a good salute to Western Kentucky University. Tonight I'd like to take you on a fast trip down memory lane, using some of the photographs from the book and some that we wish we had used. The question is often asked, why did Western develop at Bowling Green? As a transportation center on a navigable river and on the L&N Railroad, getting to Bowling Green and Bowling Green schools was relatively easy. Local interest in education was also an important part of the equation. Antebellum schools were private and temporary. For example, in 1836, a group of Warren County parents hired Henry Hines to teach, to the best of his ability, the three R's to their children. For his efforts, he received $9 per student, payable in cash and or tobacco, ham, and flour, spelled F-L-O-W-E-R. Mr. Hines soon found more lucrative work. In 1851, Elizabeth Underwood wrote to her senator husband that the area schools were of no account and concluded that she really pitied the poor schoolmaster trying to teach three or four dozen unruly boys. Can you imagine? State-supported schools were certainly needed. The move for public education had hardly begun when the Civil War pushed it aside. After the war, interest again swelled, and Bowling Green's first public schools opened in 1882. One school for white children and one school for African Americans. Both schools addressed grades 1-8. Unfortunately, the state did not provide secondary education. Consequently, area residents raised money for high schools. Ogden College, founded by Robert Ogden, opened in the 1870s and was located between 14th State and Chestnut Street. Ogden became part of Western in the 1920s. Local residents also campaigned to raise funds for a high school for women. Named for the community's most generous donor to the project, the Pleasant J. Potter College for Young Ladies opened in 1888 on the hilltop at the southern edge of town. Both colleges attracted not only local students, but also young men and women from across the South. At about the same time as the creation of Potter and Ogden schools, A.W. Mill opened a school in Glasgow to train teachers. A few years later, he moved his school to Bowling Green, where he hoped for greater support from the larger community. Unfortunately, enrollment was insufficient to support his school, and Mill sold the school to a couple of friends. By the 1890s, it appeared that his facility would close because of financial problems. Appreciating the greater need for a school to train teachers, Henry Hardin Cherry and his brother Thomas acquired Mill's school and launched an unbelievable promotional campaign. They also increased the school's academic offerings. The school survived and grew. The Cherries added a business college, acquired a building to use as a dorm. And let me point out that the first dormitory had a water hydrant behind it and slop jars under the beds. And eventually, they erected a new dorm. It had cold water piped to the bedrooms. The school's academic offerings sound quite diverse. Typing, shorthand, penmanship, teacher training, and scientific courses, and apparently appealed to both sexes. This is the 1898 graduates of the scientific class, and note the impressive number of women in the class. But operating a school was expensive, and the cost of providing classrooms and dormitories as grand as this exceeded the school's income. Cherry needed help, and it came from the state. In 1906, the Kentucky legislature created two normal schools, one at Richmond and the other, Western Kentucky Normal School at Bowling Green. A few years after Henry Hardin Cherry received the glad tidings that his school would be part of the state system, he learned that Potter College expected to close, and his Board of Regents arranged to purchase the Potter campus. On acquiring the Potter campus, Cherry asked Louisville architect Britton B. Davis and St. Louis landscape architect Henry Wright to create a master plan for the new school. Although only the administration building was constructed, Cherry's school nevertheless developed somewhat as the three envisioned. And let me point out that Davis would design most of the structures built during Western's first three decades, including Van Meter, Cherry Hall, the Kentucky Building, the President's Home, Whitestone, the Health and Physical Education Building, which is now the Helm Library, and the old library, now known as Gordon Wilson Hall. Before he could move his school to the hilltop, Cherry needed to provide additional accommodations. For about $125,000, which was then, of course, quite a fortune, he built an impressive brick and limestone administration building that would later be named Van Meter Hall. From the top of Van Meter's steps, then and now, one has a breathtaking view of the countryside. Some claim that they can see all the way to St. Louis from there. The large auditorium of the administration building opened for chapel 2 days after Western moved to its hilltop home in February of 1911. Shown here are the old Potter College classroom and dorm on the far left, which was remodeled and named Recitation Hall. And in the center is Cabell Hall, which had previously served as the home for the president of Potter College. It, too, was originally remodeled and served for more than a decade as the home for the departments of music and home economics. Cherry was a master at accomplishing a whole lot with very little money. With no funds for maintenance for his large hilltop campus, he instituted Cleanup Day that brought out faculty and students to work and to play. The annual event shown here behind Recitation Hall became a popular social event that fostered a sense of ownership and kept down the cost of maintenance. Recitation Hall would serve as Western's major classroom until the mid-1930s. During World War I, the Student Army Training Camp constructed barracks on the corner of Western's campus. And after the war, Western utilized these structures for classes and resident halls. However, in 1922, these wooden structures were demolished. And on the site, Cherry constructed a fine training school where teachers could observe children and practice teaching techniques. In the early 20th century, the majority of Kentucky's children received their education in 1- and 2-room facilities. Therefore, Cherry also constructed a model rural school on the southern end of campus, a place to train those teachers who expected to find jobs in rural areas. Between Recitation Hall and the new training school stood an old creamery that became the home of the College Heights Foundation. During Western's 100 years, the foundation, today in a far more modern building, has raised millions of dollars and helped thousands of students finance their education. As the school grew, the need for a variety of structures became apparent. Students needed a senior house or a student center. Somebody suggested that the dead cedar trees that dotted the hillside could be utilized. Built by students, supervised by faculty, and aided by some of the workers then constructing Potter Hall Dormitory, the log house, now the faculty house, also served as a banquet hall and the school's library. A gymnasium was another need for the new school. The state legislature had ruled in 1920 that physical education should be a part of every student's curriculum. Short of funds and reluctant to spend money on athletics, President Cherry called for a structure built by students with second-rate lumber. The barn-like structure seated 250. Unfortunately, the poorly built red barn was so cold and drafty that the basketball players usually practiced and sometimes even held their games in the training school's small gym. Despite Cherry's reluctance to encourage athletics, basketball teams thrived. This is the Kit Kats of 1913. Don't you know they were dynamite on the court? And this is the 1917 girls team. Each leg of those bloomers contained 2 yards of fabric. I don't know how they ever ran down the court without breaking their necks. And despite these gals' very modest attire, I mean, they're covered to their chin, men were not allowed to attend their basketball games. E.A. Diddle joined the faculty in 1922, and in his early years coached nearly every sport, including women's basketball, as well as the 1931-32 championship team. During his 42-year career, Diddle coached Western's basketball teams in all of their homes, at the Bowling Green YMCA, in the Red Barn, in the training school gym, in the health and physical education building, and in the arena that bears his name. Because the Red Barn proved inadequate, Western built a new health and physical education building, which opened in 1931. The structure's exterior is gleaming white Warren County limestone. Note the terracotta frieze across the top of the building. It is composed of alternating blocks of a floral design and Olympic athletes representing all of the Olympic sports. An Ohio coach complained once because when Western's band struck up Dixie in this building, all hell broke loose. And thereafter, he and his boys had no chance of winning. Western won 336 games of its 374 games played in this building. On the south side of the gym, Western built Bowling Green's first outdoor swimming pool, which of course no longer is there. Because of its immense size, the Health and Physical Education building also hosted a variety of non-athletic activities that were a public service and ultimately an aid to student recruitment. As the enrollment grew, the need for new structures also increased. In 1926, Cabell Hall was raised. The stone ashlars were carefully preserved, and a new library was constructed on the site. And then using materials salvaged from Cabell Hall, as well as some new materials, Western built a new home for the music and home economic departments. One of Cherry's dreams concerned the collecting and housing of all that is good and fine about the Commonwealth. In the late 1920s, he launched a campaign to raise money for such a building. Construction began on the Kentucky building in 1929. Unfortunately, the Depression delayed the structure's completion for nearly a decade. But in the meanwhile, temporary walls were put up and a few classes were held in the unfinished building during the construction of Cherry Hall. Note the columns on this building. Each one is a single piece of stone. I've looked at an awful lot of buildings, and I've never seen any other building with columns that are 35, 40 feet tall, but that are made out of a single piece of stone. They must have had some fine equipment and some fine workmanship, craftsmen in this town. The Kentucky building is really kind of the last hurrah of the stone industry here. During the school's first 2.5 decades on the hill, most classes were held in Recitation Hall. But despite the renovations and the addition of a circular fire escape, many feared that the old Recitation Hall was a fire trap. And in 1935, the old brick and wooden structure was torn down, and with the aid of federal funds, a magnificent new classroom designed by Brenton B. Davis replaced it. And this, of course, is Cherry Hall. Unfortunately, we seldom stop to notice some of the handsome architectural details on Cherry Hall. Next time you're up there, take a look. Cherry Hall is indeed one of the finest and loveliest structures on campus. The statue of Western's first president that stands in front of Cherry Hall was modeled by Laredo Taft, who is probably America's best-known sculptor for the early 20th century. Unfortunately, neither Cherry nor Taft lived to see the dedication of the building and statue in November of 1937. On the death of H.H. Cherry, Governor Happy Chandler appointed Paul Garrett as Western's second president. Mrs. Garrett was an avid gardener, and she and several faculty wives and a number of women in the community created magnificent Kentucky gardens around the Kentucky building. During World War II, the Army Air Corps sent several hundred trainees to Western. In addition to taking classes in physics, math, and geography, these young men acquired some very useful skills. Carol says they're enrolled in Ironing 101. The GI Bill offered educations to millions of World War II veterans, and post-war college enrollments skyrocketed. Surplus military trailers provided housing for some of Western's married students. In the post-war years, basketball again became the game. You might recognize some of the members of this 1948 team. From left to right, Dee Gibson, Odie Spears, Don Ray, Orrin McKinney, and Johnny Odom. Some of you also might remember this eatery, better known to many of us as the Goalpost. This was a very popular place to hang out between classes. Today, of course, it's a parking lot. A growing post-war enrollment required more new buildings, including a student center that offered study areas, game rooms, and a cafeteria. Originally, the Garrett Center was a one-story building. Today it's two. Note the wallpaper in there in the billiards parlor. It has roses or ferns on it. In the three decades following World War II, Western built 15 dormitories, 10 classroom buildings, 10 auxiliary structures, and remodeled and enlarged several others. By the fall semester of 1960, Western was the second largest school in Kentucky. Diddle Arena opened in 1963. Known for his mangled syntax, such as line up alphabetically according to height, and stand and remain seated till all names are called, Diddle is also remembered for winning 759 games during his 42-year career at Western. Jim McDaniels and his 1970-71 teammates brought nationwide recognition to Western. Shortly after Diddle Arena opened, the old physical education building was converted into a library. Or, as many students joked, the school made brawn into brain. The last ball game played in the old gym, Western lost to East Tennessee, 80-79. Don't you know that was a heartbreaker? In 1967, Western broke ground for a new stadium. Money could only be acquired from the state if the structure also housed some academic areas. And thus the stadium offers 12 classrooms, 26 faculty offices, as well as gyms and training rooms and showers and other athletic facilities. College was, and still is, more than classes and studying. Formal dances have always been favorite weekend activities. Some things change, others remain the same. These 1960 dorm rooms look rather like my daughter's rooms did in the 1980s, and probably like some of them do even today. Not all learning goes on in the classroom. For many years, Western has brought well-known dignitaries to campus, including author Pearl Buck, who spoke to a full house in Van Meter. Western won the Ohio Valley Conference in 1967 with this team: Clint Haskins, Wayne Chapman, Dwight Smith, Butch Kaufman, and Greg Smith. 4 years later, Western defeated the University of Kentucky, probably the school's most memorable victory. Let me point out that African-American athletes like the Smiths and Clem Haskins helped smooth Western's integration during the 1960s. Nevertheless, the 1960s and early 70s were tense times on campuses across the nation. We had protests against Vietnam and sit-ins demanding better representation for African-Americans in campus groups. But unlike an awful lot of other schools, Western weathered the storm with relatively little damage. And perhaps this was because there were other things that involved students, like homecoming parades and lots of athletics. Remember when students dressed like this? There's not a bosom or a tummy button or a tattoo showing on any of these young ladies, which is more than you can say if you go across campus today. The student parking lot across from McNeil School has long been named Egypt by the students, not only because it's a world away from Cherry Hall and other hilltop structures, but also because the spring rains cause flooding. Here we've got students swimming in the parking lot, but certainly not all swimming has been done in the Nile. Coach Bill Powell and his team hold an impressive number of trophies. Springtime is fun time on campus. Whether you are soaking up a few rays on a rooftop or admiring the girls in the quadrangle that's bound by McCormick, Rhodes Harlan, and Gilbert Hall, which, by the way, is dubbed the Valley of the Dolls, for some obvious reasons, by the male students, or being dragged through the mud in a tug of war during Greek Week, or watching the antics of Western's best-known student, Big Red. And speaking of Big Red, everyone loves Big Red. Students, little kids, and even big kids, like President Zacharias. In addition to having fun, college is supposed to be about learning, going to class, and studying. And of course, Western students do this in the usual as well as the unusual classroom. Caves are wonderful classrooms for students studying the karst regions of this state. Biology students can study aquatic invertebrates in nearby streams. But most classes are conducted in the traditional classroom, though chalk and blackboards are beginning to take a back seat to PowerPoint presentations. In recent years, Western has expanded to neighboring towns and now offers classes in Glasgow, Russellville, Owensboro, and Fort Knox. The original plans for Western included a clock tower, which was never built. But a few years ago, the Guthrie family gave money for this tower in memory of a loved one who was lost during the Korean conflict. Guthrie Tower has become a favorite gathering place and provides a memorable setting for fall convocations. In addition to sports, shenanigans, and scholastic endeavors, Western is well known for its prize-winning newspaper. And note the picture on the front page of this paper. Not all shenanigans are committed by students. This is our friend Carol Crow Carrico on the front page, beautifully dressed, teaching class. Not only does Western hold classes in caves, streams, and neighboring towns, we have even spread our influence to foreign ports. Last summer, Western's Woodwind Ensemble helped Russia celebrate the 50th anniversary of VE Day and had their photo taken standing in front of the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg, Russia. Graduation is, and should be, the goal of every student. And after lots of studying, as well as all those shenanigans, this is probably how every student feels on the receipt of a diploma. If you haven't visited the campus recently, do so. There are lots of new and newly renovated buildings and lots of green space that once were streets. Western is truly a beautiful campus with manicured lawns, well-tended flower gardens, and stately trees. And as this cartoon from the 1960s suggests, Western is constantly changing. You ever wondered what the campus will look like in another 100 years? Well, maybe we'll all be here to find out. Thank you.